All right. Let's see. Metronome off. And this is the 15th of June. We're in research, nursing research, discussing populations and reliability and validity. I think we'll open with probably reliability and validity. So, here we go. Thank you. These are twos.
One.
Yeah. Christine, did you see your one? I gave it to you somewhere. Test one? Excellent. Thank you so much. All right. Reliability and validity. You know basically what it means, correct? And you got it right on the exam, right? Okay, let's just talk about it a tad more because it certainly reflects on sampling. Okay? If the tool, the questionnaire, whether it's qualitative and the questionnaire is the researcher, him or herself, or it is a questionnaire, a tool, a written questionnaire, if it is a blood pressure machine, okay, no matter what you're doing to collect data, the data needs to be reliable and valid. So the tool must also have shown reliability and validity, right? Because what good is a research project if the tool is faulty? Like Nina's lovely, lovely little project, right? And she was looking at people smiling at her, but she didn't count them. Okay, so she didn't have a very good process set up there. I mean, so her tool was not even countable because, okay. So unless the project is set up well, the results aren't worthy. So validity is, as you know, and got it right today, I'm sure, the measure of truth or accuracy of a study examined with critique and controlled in conducting a study. Okay, that's validity. How valid is it? Is it looking at what it's supposed to? Okay, the accuracy of a study, is it accurately doing what it's supposed to? There are different kinds of validity. Content validity measures the degree to which the test items represent the domain of universe of the trait or property being measured. Okay, the test items, do they accurately represent? So if we wanted to represent stress in nursing students, and we tested for, we used some anxiety tests, that might not necessarily relate to stress. These could be people that had anxiety problems already. You know, many bright people go to nursing school who have all sorts of borderline anxiety issues, right? I mean, so we wouldn't not necessarily be testing what we set out to test. So the content of content validity of that tool could be wrong. The researcher must identify the overall content to be presented. Okay? Items randomly chosen from that content will accurately represent information in all areas. For instance, exam today. Hopefully the exam today was high in content validity. It did measure what it was supposed to measure, how well you were able to absorb the material. It didn't measure how much time you had to study. It didn't measure the change in weather that we all wanted to play instead of study. Right? Hopefully it truly measured your knowledge, how much you were able to absorb. Okay. Construct, the degree to which the test measures the construct it was designed to measure. Okay, there again, does it say what it's supposed to? Type 1 statistical error, type 2, do you remember this from stats? Maybe. Type 1 error is when a researcher incorrectly concludes that there is a relationship when there's no relationship. All right? So, like, Nina concluded that, that at night people smiled more because they were afraid of being,
made eye contact
more because they were concerned about being accosted on the street. They were less comfortable. Let's say we do that and we find out that people are staying at Nina because they really like the way she looks. Okay, so that's a type 1 error. She incorrectly concluded a relationship when, in reality, there was no relationship between people feeling uncomfortable and making eye contact. Okay. But that was her finding. That's what her analysis of her findings was. Okay. We don't mean to pick on you. It was just a fun little test. You did a great job with it. Okay, type 2 error is when a researcher incorrectly concludes that there is no relationship when in fact there is. Okay? So let's see, what can we use for that? Incorrectly concluded there is no relationship. Somebody's little query last time had a 50-50. What was it? Who had 50-50? Yeah, what was yours again? Yeah, it's something about men and women, and they were equal. Yes. So, and you concluded that there was equality, and that people smiled back at you. But she did that on a college campus, and again, as an attractive young woman, she's going to get more smiles. So that same study done in a different environment may be wrong. So she may have concluded that there is a relationship of when people smile, they smile back, when in reality it doesn't exist. But it showed in that small study because of some other variables, right? Like the fact that she's on a college campus, and it's a sunny day, and they like your dress, and, you know, whatever. Okay, so type 2 is when a researcher incorrectly concludes that there is no relationship when effect is. Internal validity, the confidence that an experimental treatment or condition made a difference. And rival explanations were systematically ruled out. Okay, so it's important to test internal validity, that the findings were because of the intervention, not because of anything else. Okay. They made eye contact with Nina because, as she said, they were less comfortable walking alone at night, not because they wanted to pick her up. Okay, right? Okay. Let's see what else. So we minimize the stress to validity. There should be an argument in the write-up. They should address the points of validity. Okay, they should talk about what possible threats there are to internal validity. They should definitely discuss the details of the measurements or observations. Like, what was Nina wearing? When she said, yeah, she wore the same thing in Santa Fe as San Francisco, that's good. So that's the first thing I asked, you know. And what about her design? Well, yeah, that was good. Two places, that made sense. This should be bias. Control of bias. Bias should be controlled. Okay, but maybe Nina felt more comfortable walking around Santa Fe and had a whole more comfortable presence that made people look at you, rather than maybe you were a bit on edge walking in the city at night. See, we don't know. And then the statistical analysis, okay, is another threat. Obviously, statistical analysis, if it's not done well, is certainly a threat. External validity, generalization. We talked about this, the extent to which a study findings can be generalized beyond the sample. Right? We talked about that. It's generalizable. How valid is it externally? Sometimes, often, not at all. Okay, sometimes there are some points that we can take forward. It's just the interactions of the selection of subjects, the treatment, the settings in the treatment, all may be different with a different population. Okay, so we want to minimize selection effects, time and historical effects. Let's say we were measuring the length of wait in ERs. Okay, well, there was a national disaster and all the ERs were stuffed full. That's obviously going to be an historical effect that's going to greatly impact the study, right? So we'd have to throw that out. But if someone didn't throw that out, then that would be certainly a threat to the external validity, right? And remember the novelty effect. Just because it's new and exciting, do people like this textbook over that textbook because it's new? Dr. Fink and I are choosing a new textbook for med-surg courses. I don't like the one you're using now because I think it's way too wordy and long and complex. I'd like a more simplified version. Dr. Fink likes it, but I think a lot of the reason she likes it is for the novelty effect. She's tired of the old book and just wants something new. Okay? And that's okay. But if we were doing a real study and looking at our feeling or our analysis of these two texts, I think some of her, she wouldn't be entirely valid, because I think the novelty effect is hitting her pretty hard. She'd really like a change. Okay? And the experimental effect. People are watching, therefore we're going to do a good job. Right? Remember the Hawthorne effect? That's the experimental effect. Trustworthiness is a concern, obviously, in qualitative research. Generalization is not a goal. Okay? In qualitative research, we don't even attempt to generalize. The studies are too small in most of the time. They're too confined to one area of study. But what we want instead is trustworthiness, and we want to see that in applicability and transferability of the findings. Right? So this is a study of how to talk to obese, communication between nurses and parents of obese children, right? Right, yeah, that's, I've only read page one of her literature. And actually, she's before everybody else. Okay. So these studies were set in one specific location. Are those findings transferable to other samples? Or maybe this was an area where they're very health conscious, like Marin County, which is apparently one of the most health conscious areas in the country. Is that going to be different from Modesto, you know, who has a huge problem in childhood obesity? Okay? So can findings be applied to other settings and samples? Maybe, maybe not. Are they applicable and transferable? We know they're not generalizable, but some of the study done here could be applicable. Some of the things that were found here are found in Fresno, certainly could be in Modesto, wherever, certainly could be applied here. Okay? So that's what we're looking for. Not in qualitative work, not generalizability, but transferability and applicability. Can we just apply? Replicability. Thank you. Replicability of qualitative studies. Again, credibility is enhanced when other researchers replicate the study. Okay, so it's a replicability, when it's replicated by other researchers. Okay? Then it's enhanced. Okay, so with qualitative research, we want to promote validity. We want to make sure people are looking what they're supposed to. Was there verbatim accounts? Did the researcher have prolonged experience, field experience? Is there triangulation? You know, sometimes there's some statistical data that back up the qualitative data. Member checks, remember what that is. Bracketing, remember what that is. Audit trail, remember what that is. That's as a qualitative study moves along, it tells us, okay, now we're moving here, now we're going here. You've decided to add this question because four people said it. Okay, so is there a trail of that so you can see it? Reliability of an instrument, a research instrument, is extremely important, as I said earlier. Okay. Accuracy of measure is most important. The study is worthless if the instruments aren't good. Retest method is one way to determine reliability. Okay. I just skipped a couple there, only examples. So, yeah, just examples of what retest, we give the same test to the same people. If the test is reliable, you're going to get consistency between the two tests. If it's not, you're not. So I've had several students do real projects in 4997 and 4998, do real-life data collection, but before they've developed their own tools. But I make them test their tools for reliability and validity. Get five of your friends, give them the test. Give them the test a couple days later. If they're the same, okay, we'll call it reliable. Because you've got to show that a tool is reliable or valid, or else the findings are worthless. So you should, everything you read, the tool should always be tested for reliability and validity, and it should state so. An alternate test is another way of doing it. Okay.
But it only really works for quantitative.
No, qualitative as well. Let's say I'm interviewing you about something, and then I come back a week later and you tell me a different story. You know, yeah, so that's, see? Of course, maybe some things have changed, I can take that into consideration. But if there's some basic stuff that you're changing, then you're no longer really a reliable subject. Right? So the data's not good. Okay. Certainly, we have to, when qualitative, we have to take time into consideration, because your views may have changed, something could have happened to you in the meantime, and that's, we would take all that into consideration. But basically, you should have pretty much the same story that we got the first time. Like Gretchen the dog, you know? If that study, if I got back, in fact, which I did, and asked him a couple more questions just to determine if I got everything right, I did a member check, he gave me the same answers. But if he had been completely different, I would have really questioned that subject and whether anything I had was valid or reliable. Okay? And there's all sorts of statistical ways that we can check these. Interrelator reliability is an important concept. A perfect example was, I got an email from Professor Bright, and she says, well, our interrelator reliability with the grades in lab on our fundamental students that we have this summer in skills lab are not the best. We probably need to do some work with interrelator reliability because Dr. Fink has two groups and I have two groups, okay? Dr. Fink put out, all my students are all doing great. They all got 10s on their checkups. I'm going, I didn't give any 10s. Or whatever it was. Or the first case study. First case study, everybody got 10s. I gave 2 10s. I did 24. I gave, my mean was 8.5. I'm going, you know, so I went to Professor, I said, I don't want my students to do poorly next to Professor Price because they're all really great. And she's giving 10s. And she said, yeah, interrelator reliability is a problem. Okay? So are all the researchers doing the same thing? Are all the data collectors doing the same thing? I was involved in a study where we did genitalia exams on newborns. Really fun, you can imagine. There was a group of physicians and a group of nurses. We were doing these exams. So in order to increase interrelator reliability, a couple times a year, we would all get together, examine the same infant, and compare our findings. Okay? And that should be spoken to. How do I know that you're going to get the same data that I am, especially something as absurd as a newborn genitalia exam, which is, leaves a lot of room for interpretation, let me tell you. Okay? Yeah. And the whole problem with the study is that there was no baseline. There's no baseline about what normal genitalia on a newborn should look like. But it was an environmental study sponsored by the NIH Department of Environmental, whatever, and it was to see if there were any pesticides that were impacting the genitalia of newborns. Apparently, turtles are having a real problem right now. And if you look to turtles, whatever happens to turtles, you often can see happen in mammalian population, which is very interesting. So our job was to examine the babies. And this is the second part of the study. We had examined the men and their sperm in the earlier part, and the areas with high problems with sperm supposedly should have had babies with genitalia that didn't have didn't match baseline. But the problem was there is no baseline. All right, there is no baseline, so it was a real problem. But anyway, point being, we were all brought together several times a year so that we could supposedly be measuring the same things at the same time. That study never. It was $5 million, and I don't think it ever went anywhere. There were so many problems. The pediatricians would examine the babies, and they'd let them scream and wail. The other nurse and I, we would examine them, and one peep out of them, and we'd say, oh, this child is refusing. And we'd say, no. So I think we had, between us, we had, 5 successful exams in 6 months, you know, where the pediatricians, they were getting it like this. And we just, it's the baby's right to say no. And we weren't gonna prod and poke anymore. Yeah. You get really into some ethical questions here. Because if you had been straight about telling mothers of newborn males that we were going to do a penile stretch length, how many mothers would say yes? None. So I don't think there was really full disclosure. And that's why, as soon as these babies cried, we'd say, no, we're not doing it. And there were a couple that slept through the whole thing that you could have done anything to, and they didn't care. But, you know, when you're prodding a little girl's legs apart to take a measurement, I'm sorry, we're not doing that. That's invasive. There's no way. But the pediatricians would. They just go, okay, we're done. So obviously, our interrelated reliability wasn't there at all. mostly because psychologically we kept throwing everybody out, and the pediatricians had no problem doing the exams. But point being, they tried to get us all the same and to standardize our exams. Didn't never work. So that was $5 million of U.S. funds down the tube for research, which is kind of interesting.
So would that be an ethical problem if you weren't giving complete
disclosure? I had a lot of problem with this whole course of research, in reality. And that was my biggest problem. Yeah. Another problem I had was, in the first part of this study, it was called the Study for Future Families. You can look it up. Shauna Swan is a PI, the principal investigator. Huge study. The first leg of this study was to determine if sperm counts differed in different areas of the country, right? Makes sense? So how do you find out if sperm counts differ? What?
Samples.
Let's get sperm samples. But we wanted sperm samples from men who were fertile, who had proven fertility. How do you get sperm samples from men with proven fertility? What would you think? Where would you go to find men with
school?
We went to OB offices. OB offices. And because we were in this huge, huge research university, we had the whole medical system of that university that pretty much fed the entire state and was central in this country. And so we had all sorts of opportunities to go into OB clinics and capture the men who were there with their wives or talk the women into suggesting that their husband give sperm samples for research. I want you to know that I'm the best in the country at collecting sperm. Yeah, really.
That
would scare me.
Yeah.
I average about 20 to 22%, and in the few studies that have been done around the world, less than 10, the Scandinavians were best at, but they were only 19 at that point, and I topped them. So I had a 20% success rate, which is pretty good. Okay, anyway, so there were some ethical issues there. The one problem being this gentleman, so we would do exams on the men, and they would have a sperm analysis, analysis of their semen, of course. Okay, so this one time, this gentleman, we always told the men that they could have the results, always. Nobody ever asked for results. This one guy did. I said, no problem. I'll be happy to get them for you and send them off. And he said, super, thanks. That'd be great. So I went up to the lab technician and said, I want so-and-so's numbers. And she goes, oh, they're two. I said, what? Two million? She says, no, two sperm. This is the man with the pregnant wife in the OB clinic.
Oh.
Yeah. Ethically, where are we now? I'm supposed to tell this guy? No way. I'm not going there. And that's what I said. I went to the physician who was head of the clinic, where we were, that was the, where we collected the sperm, and he was a part of our study, and I said, I'm not telling him. I said, there's no way I'm telling him. So the only way I'm telling him is if, we have, the police and the clergy and a psychiatrist. If we have all these people sitting there, then I might tell him, but otherwise, I'm not telling him. And he goes, I won't sign this letter, because it was just like a fill-in standard thing. And he goes, oh, no problem, I won't sign it. He said, 20% of babies born in this country aren't born to their fathers anyway. No, but this physician had, this endocrinologist had he was a fraternity specialist, and he said, I have no problem signing it. I said, okay, so I addressed the letter, he signed it, off it goes, and then, every time I went into my office, I'm like, he's going to call, I know he's going to call, because he knew when I was in my office, right?
Did he get a test to see if it was his?
It was his. There wasn't any. So he calls, and I'm sweating, And he calls and says, and he sounded okay. And I'm going, hi. And he said, I got the results of my sperm test and my analysis. I said, oh yes. And he says, it's a little low. And I said, it is a little low. And I'm like, and I go, I understand. understand that sperm counts can be diminished when taking antibiotics. I went, that's true. And he said, well, you know, about a month ago I had strep throat and I took a series of antibiotics. I said, bad. Oh, well, that could be significant. And he said, yeah, that's what I thought. Thank you very much. But see how you get into these sticky things? So you think research is nice and clean, right? No. You can get into very sticky wickets with that. And so, yeah, was that ethical? No. What did the researchers think of that? No. So, like, when you have to think of potential problems and what you're going to, how you're going to protect your subjects, right? This is something that they should have thought of. I don't know if they should, could have. But I hope, hopefully, in projects like this, that would be worked in. What is our backup? How are we going to handle this? If someone wants their results, and it's obvious that they could never have fathered that child, that was a bit of a concern. So you see how researchers really need to think of everything. But in this, I don't know, I don't think I ever would have thought of that ahead of time. That was something. Just an example, but what about the ethics of it? You know, yeah, would it ethically have been right to tell that man? I didn't think it was. I had some real problems with that. Well, I also had problems with the babies, but anyway. It was not a nursing study. It was an epidemiological study.
Was the baby his, though, or not his sperm?
No, there's no way the baby could have been his. Absolute true sperm? No. It's absolutely impossible. I mean, that's one in a bazillion chances. There's no way. No.
Did they do a test?
No. Oh, no, he was happy because he thought it was because it was antibiotics. So he went along with his life. I wasn't going to tell him there's absolutely no way. All I said was, yes, that is true. You know, there can be an impact. That's true. Right? That is true. And that's all I said. And then he went off and spun his own thing. And I said, fine, thank you very much. No, I'm not going there. Was that ethical on my part? Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell him. I mean, I don't know. But you can see the dilemma. Well, I wasn't even sending the letter. I didn't know what to do. But as nurses, obviously, we do have very high ethics. And we're very concerned with the holistic person, right? The physician, no problem. These results, he can get them. That's it. He had no problem sending them. Me, on the other hand, I had a great deal of problems. Okay, let's talk about settings and samples. This is very important. So the way the sample is chosen is extremely important. Okay, that's sampling theory. And there are various plans and methods available to studies for how they're going to choose their samples. So sampling, by definition, is selecting a group of people, events, or behaviors when you conduct a study. Every study needs a sample, right? You had some samples when you went out and did your little study. Okay? You need samples. Samples doesn't necessarily have to be people. It can be behaviors, which some of you studied, right? It could be events. Events, how many cardiac arrests are there between the hours of 3 and 6 in the morning? Okay? Or other elements. Okay? It doesn't necessarily have to be a person. It can be a fact or an observation. But it's selecting a group of people, events, whatever, that's going to be used as a basis to conduct the study. And that whole group is called an element, all right, just for the purposes of discussion, whether it's an event, a person, whatever. So the selected group of people, elements, from which the data are collected. That's the sample. You get the data from the sample. Obviously, then, it must be very sound. You must have excellent sampling techniques. Okay. It's important that Nina wore the same thing as Santa Fe, and okay, all that kind of thing is very important. Members in the sample are called subjects or participants. Okay. The population is, and this is important, the population is the entire set of individuals who meet the criteria. This is also called the target population. So my graduate student who was doing querying nurses in the Bay Area, her target population was simply Bay Area nurses. And that's what she had. That wasn't her sampling set, but that was her target population. Okay? So the population is the entire set of individuals that meet that criteria, the target population. Now the accessible population is a portion of the target population that the researcher has reasonable access to. In the case of my graduate student, she was able to contact the State Board of Nursing, get the names and addresses of all the nurses who currently live in the Bay Area. Okay, she probably missed a couple, who recently moved to the area, right, who were in the process of getting their license. Nonetheless, so she didn't have all of them. So her accessible population were the ones on that list, which was most of the entire population, right, in this case. It might not be, though. If I was going to do something about Bay Area nursing students, you would be an accessible population. College of Marin would, you know, I'd go kind of where it was easy for college. It was easy for me, my accessible population. Okay? The portion of the target population which the researcher has reasonable access is accessible population. So we discussed what an element was, one individual unit of a population. Okay? One unit of the population is an element. So we're starting big and coming down. So we have the population, the target population, and the accessible population, and the element that's in there. We've talked about generalization a couple times. You know about that. Inclusion. When you're looking at sampling, there should be some criteria for inclusion and exclusion. Okay. So sample characteristics for inclusion are an adult between the ages of whatever, ability to speak English. In every study I've done, I've had to put the ability to speak English because that's the only language I speak. So that's limiting in itself, isn't it? This is a study on cholecystectomies, so admitted for gallbladder surgery. And maybe they want to correlate cholecystitis with diabetes, so they want newly diagnosed diabetics. Okay? Well, that would be an example of an inclusion criteria, probably for a study that was seeing if there's a correlation between newly diagnosed diabetics and cholecystitis, right? And so that's exactly what they want. That's their inclusion criteria. But they also want some people, there's some people they don't want. They don't want anybody diagnosed with mental illness because they want them to be able to fill out their questionnaire and talk to them. They don't want anybody less than 18 years old because they stated 18 to 45. That's what we're looking at. We don't want anybody that has any diagnosis of cognitive dysfunction. All right? I have a son that says severe dyslexic. You wouldn't want to give him a written piece of paper and pencil sampling. I mean, he'd mix up his numbers and he has trouble, he reverses everything. And so he would, even though he's brilliant, I would certainly exclude him because of a cognitive dysfunction. Okay, and the ability to speak English. If anyone's unable to speak, then you'd fill them out. Or I would in anything I was doing. Okay. So generally, you should see when your study that you're reading describes sampling, there should be inclusion and exclusion criteria. They should make sense for the study. Okay? They should make sense. So remember, in the problem purpose statement, they're going to operationalize children. Let's say we're looking at childhood diabetics, and then they're going to tell you what a child is. So that should then correlate. The exclusion criteria should exclude anybody over 18 or younger than 5 or whatever they've defined a child to be, okay? So make sure that all works. So there are a couple of different kinds of samples. Remember, we talked a little bit about this last time. A homogeneous sample is as similar as possible to each other in order to control for extraneous variables. So there are times when you want a homogeneous sample. You want the people all the same because of something you're studying. So you want as much homogeneity as possible. There are other times when you're looking at a more broad, or like a perfect example. A couple years ago, I had 4 male Asian nursing students in my class. If anybody wanted to measure male Asian nursing students, there they were. It would be perfect. A nice homogeneous mix. There they were. They were all the same. They looked the same. They were the same height. They had the same, you know, I mean, they were perfect. A nice homogeneous mix. Okay? So if I want this, I want to rule out absolutely everything else but one factor, they would be a perfect set to study. Okay? Heterogeneous is when we want broader range. We want a lot of input, a lot of different things we're looking at. We're not narrowly focused on a lot of things. Be careful about inappropriate generalizations as you read about samplings. samples cannot be generalized beyond their sampling criteria. Okay? So you say children between 5 and 18, and then you report something on 4-year-olds? No. Okay, so be very careful that it all fits in. There's nothing that doesn't make sense. Everything correlates. There might be inappropriate generalizations due to language or reading ability. Okay. And maybe something that people, inappropriate generalization to other type of illnesses. Well, since we found this in this population, it could be found in this, or this reading ability, and this, or these Spanish speakers, so these, no. Okay. So make sure. And that's a real problem. We had problems in the Study for Future Families. When we were contacting the men, it was a multi-site, nationwide study. So we had Hispanics in New York and Hispanics in California, very different. We could make no generalizability. We could not generalize from either coast because the populations were very different, even though they're both Spanish speakers. And we had Spanish speaking data collectors in both. But we couldn't have then said, this is... They were so different because culturally they were completely different people. Representativeness, the sample, the access population, the target population are as like in many ways as possible. Okay. So if the sample I choose for my study should be very representative of the larger sample. All right. If I am looking at nursing students and I pick those 4 Asian males, they're not very representative of all the nursing students, are they? No. Probably most of the questions would want a more heterogeneous mix. That would be so then the ideas would be representative of all of them. Okay? Of all of you, everybody. So make sure there's representativeness. The sample that you choose should reflect the target population and obviously the accessible population as much as possible. You need to always evaluate the setting in which the data was collected, okay, and the environment, and the subject of the setting, like my continued problem with the breast cancer studies around here, right? Think about age, gender, ethnicity, income, education. Are those all impacting the study? Can we compare Kaldraman and Dominican students in their abilities upon graduation? Not really. I don't think we can, because their characteristics are too different. But if we take someone who is already an LVN, graduates from Dominican, yeah. Is that person going to be representative of a regular Dominican BSN grad? No. See, so make sure that there's representativeness. The characteristics of the subjects match. Sampling error is the difference between the population mean and the mean of the sample. Okay? I think I have it. Yeah, there we go. So here's the population. Let's say this is the average grade. Oh, dear. Go back. This is the NCLEX is good to use with this. Let's say this is Dominican. Dominican is a sample. And this is the national mean. Okay? So we're that far off the national mean, and hopefully it's not due to sampling error. Okay? It may be, right? But we're hoping it's not. But sampling error is the difference between what you expect from the population and what you get from your sample. Okay. Our concern is that it's not sampling error, that there's some reason why the scores are different. Hopefully all of the scores are going to be really high compared to the general population because we're so great. That's what we'd like to see. But still, because of the difference, there's a problem. We have to address it. Why are we different? Well, because we're so great. Or why are we poor? Well, or maybe there's simply a problem in the sampling. The sample should be more representative. You want your sample representative of the population in general as a researcher. Not necessarily as an educator, but as a researcher, you want the sample to represent the population, right? Because then you can, it's more generalizable if it truly does represent the population. Okay. sampling error. There could be some random differences. Okay, sure. Things could be high and low. There could be some systematic variation, like biases. All right. Let's say, in a study for future families, when I was collecting men to give sperm samples, I had found through experience that people of East Indian ethnicity didn't want to talk to me. And it was really a waste of time. They would never, ever say yes. Because of that, I stopped asking people. I was biased. I stopped asking people of East Indian, at least who looked culturally East Indian, because I felt I was wasting my time. Therefore, our study had no East Indians in it. So that could very well have been some sampling bias on my part, right, as an investigator, because I stopped asking it. Okay? That was my call, probably not a good one. Random variation is a difference in values that occur when different subjects from the same sample are examined. There's going to be some variation, like in our sperm samples. Right? That makes sense. Systematic variation or systematic bias. Okay, the consequence of selecting subjects whose measurement differ in some way. Let's say that there's a known correlation between men who are outgoing and willing to give sperm samples and men who are, let's say they have higher sperm counts than men who are outgoing out there than men who are more reserved. Okay? Let's just say there's not. But let's just say there was. All right? Then our study would have been very swayed, right? Because the men who were giving samples were the ones who were out there. Okay? So you want to make sure there's no systematic variation. And refusal rates. Refusal rates are important. And a write-up of research should speak to refusal rates, the percentage of subjects that declined to participate. So in the study for future families, it was 80% declination rate. They didn't want to. They refused. And a 20% acceptance. All right? That showed you how hard it was to get the population to study, the study population. Sample mortality is when people withdraw from the study. In studying breast cancer survivors, we had a lot of people who simply said, I'm overwhelmed, I can't come in, I don't want to participate anymore. It was a longitudinal study. And a lot of women just said, this is too much, I know I said I'd do it, I'm in the middle of treatment, I can't handle it. So we had a lot of dropouts. And that rate should also always be mentioned, what was the sample mortality. Granted, in the breast cancer study, we did have a few die, it was true mortality. But we had a lot more dropout. And they're all termed sample mortality. Okay? They're no longer with the study. What does this do to a researcher, especially on a longitudinal project? We had a 3-year project. People left during the third year. You know, we started with like 250. We were down to like, I don't know, 80 or something by the end. People kept falling out. They'd move, they'd die, they didn't want to do it anymore. That was a real problem. The NIH wanted 200 people. We didn't have it. And certainly all the write-ups on that study should address this problem of mortality. Because we came down to an 80 person sample at the end. That's not half as strong as 250, isn't it? Right? Random sampling increases the representativeness of the sample based on the target population, right? So if I am randomly choosing people, it's more representative, isn't it? Like the graduate student who surveyed nurses, she took every fifth person from her list. Completely random. Okay? A control group used in studies with random sampling. You're the control, you're the not, da, 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 okay? Comparison groups are not randomly determined. If I want to look at this group of students and compare them to a group of students in New York, I might say, okay, I want this ethnic mix. I want this class level. I want this grade of students. Okay? Then I have a true comparison group. I haven't randomly selected. Now I can probably compare a little better. Because now the differences are going to be based on geography and what's going on at that school versus the students themselves, the maturity level, the ethnicity, the gender, okay? The educational background. So a comparison group is not randomly determined. Control group is. You're here. That's it. So there's a little bit of difference there. Know that. A sampling frame is a list of every member in the population. Okay? So my graduate student had the whole list from the BRN of nurses. That is her sampling frame. From that, the subjects are selected from the frame. Okay? So sampling plan outlines how you're going to sample. Strategically, how you're going to sample these people. There are probability sampling plans and non-probability sampling plans. So probability samplings are simple random, stratified random, clustered, and systematic. Okay? And probability sampling plans are usually, almost always, used in quantitative research. Non-probability sampling plans, convenience is used in quantitative, quota in quantitative and qualitative, purposeful is in both, network is in both, and theoretical. And I think I go on to, yeah, let me tell you what those are. Okay, simple random sampling is randomly choosing the sample, period. You can draw them from a set of numbers. There are random sample databases that are just numbers. Give all your people a number, pull this, and they say, okay, I take 1, 7, 25, and it just goes down completely randomly. Okay? You can also just draw names out of a hat. That's another way to have a simple random sample. So there's an example of a table of random numbers. It's just computer generated. You know, you number your subjects 1 to, what have we got, maybe 100, and you take that. Take all those numbers. Stratified now ensures that all levels of identified variables are adequately represented. This is when you're going to say, I want to query the students at Dominican. I'm going to take the same number of freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors. Okay. And I also want the same number of men and women. And I want the same number of majors. Okay, that's really stratified. But it's going to give a real clear view, right? So there may be some things that you want every single group represented. You want gender represented, and you want majors represented. So sometimes stratified random samplings are important. Then the subjects are randomly selected within that stratification. Okay, got it? Cluster sampling is all areas with the elements of the identified population are linked. Okay? Generally, this is geographic. So we're going to say we're going to take a set, like we did in the study for future families. We took a set of sampling from LA, from New York, from Minnesota, and I was in Columbia, Missouri. Okay, they were our cluster samplings throughout the country. And generally, cluster samplings have to do with geography, and generally, the goal is a fairly diverse sample. Systematic sampling is selecting the whatever from the list. This is what the graduate student did. She got a big list, 250. She took every fifth person all the way down and sent them her questionnaire. Okay. This requires that the researcher must know the number of elements in the population and the sample size desired. Okay. So there's some non-probability samplings and quantitative analysis, convenience, and quota samplings. A convenience sampling is also called accidental. It's kind of weak. The sample is basically anybody who's available and willing to give consent. Convenience. Anybody who says yes. Is it representative? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. Depending on what you're looking at. Quota uses a convenience sampling, but with a strategy to ensure inclusion of different study types. So I'm going to take the first 4 women and the first 4 men, and then I want the first 4 women that are under 25, and men that are under 25, and then who are between 25 and 30. And that's it. So I have stratified. Okay, stratified to gender and to those 2 age groups. Okay. So certainly, you have to have a sample size of qualitative data large enough to show the effect, right? You don't want the effect to be a chance. Quota. Yeah. It's convenient sampling, but you have a quota that you want in each group. Another example would be in a breast cancer study I was doing, I wanted the study to be representative of the population, ethnic makeup of that geographical area. So I knew I had to get 60% Caucasian, I had to get 5% Asian, and I knew exactly how many people from each ethnic group. And I wanted that because I wanted my sample population to represent the ethnicity of that area. Because then I could say it was truly representative of the area. So then I had a quota sample. I took the first however many white people in the first however. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. That's a quota sample. If you have to have enough subjects that the effect size, meaning the response to the intervention, is based on the intervention, based on what you did, not just by chance. The larger the size of the sample, the more likely it's going to be because of your intervention, not by chance, right? So sample size and quantitative work is very important. The type of quantitative study that's conducted, the number of variables, this measurement sensitivity, how sensitive is the measurement? Are we doing blood pressure measures? Or are we doing something else that maybe not might not be so sensitive? And then the data analysis techniques. Okay. This all makes up how big of a sample size you're going to need for a specific quantitative study. There's such thing as a power analysis. You may see this mentioned. A power analysis tells the researcher, it's a statistical data, it's a whole thing that the statisticians can go through, that will give the researcher a very firm idea of how many subjects they need to show that the alpha is whatever level of significance is. You can choose. Okay? Which means that if an alpha has a standard power of 0.8, that means that only 0.8 of the findings would have happened from chance. The rest of them happened because of your intervention. Okay? So levels of significance, alpha equals whatever you can choose. Yeah, we would like it only 1%, right? That'd be great. Only 1% was for chance. Everything else was because of my intervention. So but if it's like 20, you know, that's horrible. An alpha 0.2, 20% could be due to chance. What are you going to, that's not very good. Okay, so a power analysis will tell you how many people you need to come up with a decent level of significance. Okay? 0.8 is the standard power. Alpha, we prefer a level of significance that was a little lower. Okay. So check the alpha level of the studies you're reading. If it's 0.8, you know, that means that 8 out of 100, that would have happened by chance, not your intervention. Maybe that's okay, depending on what you're looking at. You know, maybe it's not. Okay? So the lower, the better. The effect size. The effect is the presence of the phenomena being studied. Okay? Is it there? Did people improve because of my intervention? Often increasing the sample size is going to increase the effect size. Okay, the more steady, the more people you work with, you're going to see a greater effect. Yeah. Let's see. We want to. What can happen with chance? Oh, the exam. Okay. Let's say someone's taking an exam, and they go through, and they don't even read the questions. Okay. But they get this one specific question right that we're looking at, okay? At an alpha of 0.05, that's going to happen in 5 out of 100 people, okay? They're going to get that question right just by chance, not because they studied. So if I'm trying to see how well I taught the course by looking at that, I know that 5% are going to answer that question just by chance. It had nothing to do with my teaching intervention. Okay? Just by chance, it's going to happen. Okay? Nothing to do with the intervention and the teaching and the learning. Just happen. So you want your level of significance as small as possible. Because then you know that the difference that you're finding, the findings that you are showing, is because of the intervention, not just because it's chance. Does that help? And power analysis is a statistical analysis that tells a researcher how many they need to have it, to have the outcomes, not just by chance. to whatever level they want to choose. So the effect size is the presence of the phenomena being studied. When the effect size is large, there's a large variation between groups, only a small sample is needed. This really changes. This really makes a huge difference. We don't need so many people. When it's more subtle, we need more people. Okay? So if you're saying everybody who stops smoking decreases their chances of heart attacks, or we know that data is really good, we can have a smaller sample size because there's a direct correlation. It's a heavy effect. Okay? But if we're going to say that something that has a more subtle effect, then we need a larger population to observe, okay, to have an effect size, to have it work. Okay. And here's some just examples. Let's see, you guys, let's just go for a little bit longer. Okay, just a couple points. The number of variables, meaning how many things are we studying, how many are we looking at? We're studying more things, we need a larger sample size. That makes sense, right? Okay, the more things we're looking at, the larger sample size. And sometimes there are several different things we're looking at if it's a complex hypothesis. Number of variables, larger sample size. Smaller variable, we can get away with smaller sample size. Sensitivity of the instrument. If the tool is very, very good at measuring what it's going to measure, very reliable, very valid, we need a smaller sample size. Okay? And these should all be addressed. The data analysis techniques, you've had stats. It's very important that the data analysis techniques be mentioned in the studies. So when you critique a sample, you're going to want to identify the elements, the accessible population, the target population. Absolutely. Always. Okay? Evaluate the appropriateness of generalization, if they've made any. Are they generalizing it? If so, is it appropriate? Sometimes, particularly in quantitative studies, it is. So take a good look and see what you think. Identify the sample criteria. What was the inclusion and exclusion criteria? Does that make sense to you? Was it appropriate? Judge it. Was it appropriate? What about how they got their samples? Was it all from cluster sampling, asking other people? Snowball sampling, asking other people? Maybe. Okay. Is that good or bad? Is that appropriate? Was the sample heterogeneous or homogeneous? Okay, these are things you're going to look at. And does that make sense? Was the sample size identified? There should always be a small n equals whatever. That's the population. If they're talking about the numbers in the entire population, that's going to be a big N. Never can you query the entire population, right? That's impossible. For the small N, N equals whatever, is going to be the number that represents the size of the sample of the study. Did they talk about those people who consented and those who didn't? Who decided not to be in the study and why? What about sample mortality? Did they talk about that? Was the sample size adequate? Did they have the numbers? Was it adequate? And do you feel it was adequate to make any conclusions about the findings? Right? So sample is extremely important. Was there a sampling plan? Was the sampling plan effective? Was the sample representative of the population? In what ways was it not representative? Was there a power analysis? How about type 2 errors? How about bias? How about generalizations? Okay. In qualitative research, we use more non-probability samplings, purposeful samplings, meaning choosing a sample, network or snowball, we've talked about that, theoretical samplings. Purposeful samplings is a judgment sample. I'm going to choose you because you've had that experience and I want to talk to you about it. That's very purposeful. We talked about what snowball or networking samplings are, right? If I'm going to query sex workers or longboard skateboard racers, I need somebody on the inside that's going to put me in touch with other ones, right? Because I'm not a part of those cultures. Okay. Theoretical sampling is used in grounded theory, and data is gathered from any individual that can provide relative data to generate the theory. And diversity is encouraged, okay? Basically, anybody who can help generate the theory is theoretical. Can you help move it forward? So qualitative, the scope of the study is important, the nature of the topic, the quality of the data, how much do you want, and the study design. Is it phenomenological? Is it ethnographic? Okay. Ethnographic, you probably need a little more than you need just phenomenological, depending on what you're doing, because you'd be looking at an entire culture, not just an individual. So that's all very important. How broad? Broad studies require larger samplings. Okay. Narrow scope studies can require a few. The nature of the topic. I had a friend sampling mothers who were carrying infants with physical deformities. It's a very small sample, right? And qualitative, obviously. And she had an N of like 3. Because that made sense for what she was doing. How rich is the data? Okay, again, always. And what were there better sources to get that material? Were there better places to get it? How many interviews were carried out? What did they do? Was it adequate? Do you think it was adequate? Okay. Or was there more that could be done? Inclusion criteria, sampling plan, adequate size, again, refusal, mortality rate should all be put. Remember the idea of saturation. That's your word, Sonia, saturation of data. Okay? Was that all defined? This is how you're going to critique samples in qualitative. And there's some examples. All right, I think you've had it. Let's do a project where you completely fall asleep on me. Okay? Let's see. Settings. We'll talk about settings just a little while. So you can't take it anymore. Oops. You stopped. Stop GarageBand. And we'll do our little project. GarageBand, welcome back. We're going to, hopefully we've woken up the class now. We are going to continue. Everybody's awake, I'm hoping. We're going to finish up the lecture about samples. And I think setting is the next topic of discussion. We just did a little sampling quiz. Everybody did beautifully. It was wonderful. Okay, setting, sample, population, element, criteria, representativeness, error. You got that error thing, right, guys? You understand the error thing? Got that? You weren't dozing, snoozing during that part? Non-probability, purposeful, theoretical, scope of study. Study design. Examples. Settings. Okay, the setting of a study is very important, particularly if it's qualitative work, right? A natural or field setting is uncontrolled. Telling it to go with the laptop. Okay, natural field study, uncontrolled in real life. The studies that you did last week were field studies, right? Uncontrolled. You went out into real life and you did some observations for your study. Now, partially controlled setting is manipulated or modified by the researcher. So, you sure should. They're in the same. It's the same. It should be the same. Partially controlled. For instance, I was doing a qualitative study on lymphedema patients. I had coffee with each of them at the same place. So I partially controlled the environment. I took them out of their natural environment. I put them somewhere. I was very careful where I sat them. I was looking out. They were looking at me against a wall. So I partially controlled it. Okay? Yet there were still people coming in. It was a public area. But I partially controlled the setting because I wanted their attention, right? I wanted them all to me. I didn't want them distracted. And I wanted them to feel comfortable in an environment so we could talk like friends, not like in a clinic environment or an office environment. So I controlled the environment partially, but I certainly didn't control the humidity, the temperature, the weather, who was coming in, all that kind of thing, what kind of coffee they ordered, okay? This is seen in correlational, quasi-experimental, experimental, of course, in some qualitative work. Highly controlled is artificial in the lab. Right, you control everything in the laboratory environment. And these are seen in experimental studies. External validity is the extent to which a study can be generalized from the study sample. Populations, measurements, instruments, and settings. Is it valid in another setting? All right. Is some of the, or maybe we're researching students that take this course in the fall, can we then generalize to the summer course? The setting is completely different. The feeling is completely different. Can we generalize? Even if the content's the same, it may be very different, right? The approach and your mindset. How does a population study represent the larger population? Okay, is it generalizable? All right. Anything else on this topic? No. When you're ready to leave, I can tell. All right, go work on your lit reviews. Come talk to me, those of you who... Rachel has our whole list of questions. Very excited. She runs right out to make sure she doesn't have to wait. Even though you're the last person that has to talk to me.